I remember correctly, but they were also asked at that time to produce receipts of what was lost, etc. So it was a big fight, and it came from the community itself, and it was something that even Japanese Americans, my parents, for example, did not want to talk about. It was a shameful, and you know, in terms of blaming the victim, they really felt that, you know, let bygones be bygones.
The government.
Well, and Japanese Americans as well. But I think, you know, and that's what
we have part 5 seconds.
And we needed to bring out the truth and ask our parents to really talk about what had been covered up.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but it certainly won't be the last time we discuss this. Richard Reeves, author of Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese-American Internment in World War II, and Karen Ishizuka, third-generation American of Japanese descent, who was part of the Asian-American movement in Los Angeles.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Inner City Blues Festival's Healing the Healthcare Blues on Saturday, April 16th from 6 p.m. to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. The campaign for universal healthcare for every citizen is growing around the United States. Our local organization, Healthcare for All Oregon, has brought the movement to the stage for an outreach and fundraising mega concert featuring Vicki Stevens and the True Blue Lady Cat, Rosalind Hunters with LaRonda Steele, Terry Robb, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. KBOO will be broadcasting live from the event. Again, that's Healing the Healthcare Blues on Saturday, April 16th from 6 p.m. to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Imagine the Sound, showing Wednesday, April 20th at 7 p.m. Imagine the Sound is an eloquent tribute to Cecil Taylor, Archie Shepp, Paul Blay, and Bill Dixon, artists that helped forge the avant-garde jazz of the 1960s. Again, that's Imagine the Sound, Wednesday, April 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a forum for Portland Mayor on Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. This forum is in participation with the Buckman Community Association. More voter information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a 12-hour public hearing is set for tomorrow at Clark College in Vancouver for the public to voice concerns about the proposed oil terminal there.
The Oregon Department of Agriculture is set to begin aerial spraying of the BTK insecticide over parts of North Portland and the Port of Vancouver.
And the governors of Oregon and California have signed an agreement to remove 4 dams from the Klamath River.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 11th, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. The Oregon Department of Agriculture is set to begin aerial spraying of the BTK insecticide over parts of St. John's, the northwest Portland Hills around Linton, and the Port of Vancouver. Last year, state biologists caught 5 gypsy moths in traps, leading the state to develop the aerial spraying plan to be implemented this spring. Spraying set to begin this Saturday morning. The areas to be sprayed run from south of Skyline Boulevard northwards over the Linton area, then continuing north over St. John's and onto the Port of Vancouver. The homes of more than 4,000 residents will be directly sprayed during the process. Although the insecticide is considered non-toxic to humans and animals, the Agriculture Department has stated that anyone that's immunocompromised or has serious food allergies may want to leave the area during the aerial spraying. It's also suggested that people keep their animals inside during the active phase of the aerial spraying. To be informed of the exact time the spraying will happen, people can go to the OregonInvasiveSpeciesCouncil.org website and click on the gypsy moth link towards the bottom of the page. From there, people can sign up for both emails and text messages on the actual time the aerial spraying will begin.
A 12-hour public hearing is set for tomorrow at Clark College in Vancouver for the public to voice concerns about the proposed oil terminal there. Last week, the port issued a staff recommendation to reject the renegotiation of its contract from Vancouver Energy. Vancouver Energy had initially asked for a 2-year lease extension because their current deal is set to expire later this year. The company sought the extension to continue project plans for what would become the largest oil transport terminal in the United States. Project backers had 3 years to collect permits needed to start the project, and that deadline comes up this August. The port commissioners will meet on April 15th to vote on whether to renew the contract.
The governors of Oregon and California met at an event on the Klamath River Wednesday and signed an agreement to remove 4 dams from the river. The two governors have decided to move forward without congressional approval, but will have help from the federal government and energy company PacifiCorp. David Kesters of KBOO News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown and California Governor Jerry Brown met at an event along the Klamath River Wednesday to agree to remove 4 dams from the river. They were joined by Native American tribal leaders, the electric utility PacifiCorp, and other groups interested in restoring the Klamath River to its natural state. Brian Johnson was at the event representing Trout Unlimited, a national group seeking the removal of the dams in order to improve fishing in the region.
The Klamath River is already one of the great steelhead rivers in the country, and this is the biggest single thing that can be done to make steelhead fishing better.
Under the agreement now set to move forward, 4 older hydroelectric dams that provide very little power would be removed starting in 2020. Without the dams, water quality on the Klamath is expected to improve and salmon habitats will be restored. 3 Native American tribes rely on salmon in the river for sustenance. U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell also was present for the signing of the agreement. Jewell and the states are working with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in order to bypass Congress, which refused to sign on to the agreement last year. PacifiCorp will also be a big player in the removal of the dams. Johnson says the company has weighed the cost and determined removing them is the best option.
The high cost of relicensing the dam and trying to retrofit them to meet modern standards would be worse, both in terms of risk to their customers and cost.
PacifiCorp has capped the price of the dam removal for its customers at $200 million, and the state of California is expected to pay the remaining balance of the $450 million project. The Public Utility Commissions of both Oregon and California have agreed dam removal is the best option for PacifiCorp customers. For KBOO Evening News, I'm David Kesters.
Too many East Portland school kids are missing classes because they can't afford the bus. A new report from environment group OPAL and the Youth Environmental Justice Alliance reveals nearly half of children surveyed struggle to pay the fare, and that's affecting their education. They're hoping the findings will convince decision makers to extend the Youth Pass scheme, which provides free TriMet passes for young people in the Portland Public Schools District, to their area too. KBOO reporter Les Hudson has more.
We need to demonstrate in this city that we value our students, and that includes the students who live east of 82nd.
Mary Lou Baitke, Park Rose School Board volunteer, speaking at the launch of a youth penned report into the state of public transportation in East Portland and its effects on school kids in the community. The Youth Environmental Justice Alliance, in association with environment group Opal, surveyed over 2,000 students in the area, many of whom said a lack of free transit has had a negative impact on their education, work and access to recreation. But they say there's a simple solution, at least in principle: extend the city's youth pass scheme. Mary Lou Baitke says the size of the school catchment means many students must travel great distances to attend classes.
If you look at how the district of Park Rose is made, we go into the middle of David Douglas and we incorporate the airport. If I'm a kid living up in where David Douglas could be, how am I getting home after the school buses stop running? I either have to wait for my parents or I have to pay full price for a bus.
But Park Rose School District has a fleet of yellow buses, so why are some children still missing out? Dr. Karen Grays, the district superintendent, speaking of the launch, she pointed out that while the service is good, it has its limitations, and so do their funds.
They can't take students to jobs, and they can't take students to much-needed personal services that they need to have in order to make their lives better. Having a TriMet bus pass will allow our students and our families to be able to get where they need to go. A lot of times, East Portland, in my opinion, gets criticized for not utilizing public transit enough, but we rely on these buses and we need more access to rapid transit and public transit. We became really concerned with the fact that there was such a huge price tag and our school district don't have that kind of money, and we're not going to have that kind of money.
And what about the young people who compiled the report? Tommy Jay is one of them. He understands well the barriers faced by some of his fellow students and the problems that can arise when classes are missed.
There are some people that live out of district from us, to the point where they actually either have to get rides from their parents, or they have to take the TriMet bus, which is going to take longer. And parents may work in the morning, so they got to take the bus. Missing one day means you're behind already, especially when you struggle with math. It's tough.
Magalia has been volunteering with Viaja and Opal for some time. Although she isn't personally affected, she says involvement in the research has given her a detailed insight into the wider effects and the need to find more funds to extend the scheme.
I've gotten to meet with David Douglas' principal and talk to him more about the problem and how we could expand the youth pass to David Douglas. I've also gotten the opportunity to know more about how it also is affecting Portland. We want to have permanent funding for it because, we don't want to struggle like other students are. And I think it's just important to have it in our daily lives because it's a big need. A lot of my friends go to East Portland schools, so seeing them struggle missing the school bus or missing school affects their education pretty much. And it just makes me feel sad that they're not having the same benefits as I am.
Over the years, Youth Pass has been threatened with funding cutbacks rather than expansion. Opal's executive director is Huey Ong. He's hoping the report's launch and the dedication of the students involved will help secure not only a future for Youth Pass generally, but also encourage decision makers to see the considerable benefits of making it available to all.
The opportunity here today is to actually lift up the stories of the directly impacted folks and the students, and talking about their experiences on and off the bus and what Youth Pass would mean for them. The report and the 2,500 surveys that were gathered were all led by youth, right? They put together the data, they actually did the research, and they pieced together an amazing report. And I think we should get it in the hands of both decision makers, community members, as well as other leaders in the city and beyond. We're excited to work with elected officials to really think creatively and innovatively, but also challenge them to hold what they say as priorities to the fire, because we also believe that you have to put the resources, the money where your mouth is. So if you believe that Youth Pass really is about equitable access to the programs and really provides a necessary service to our Portland Public Schools district school students as well as students outside of that district, then we have to find the resources to do so. And we're happy to engage those elected officials and other members of the community in figuring out the solutions.
It remains to be seen whether the arguments for extending Youth Pass eastwards will translate into action. What is certain, though, is that the 41% of David Douglas students and 45% of Park Rose kids who say they've been forced to stay at home all insist their education has suffered and will continue to suffer as long as they struggle to meet their travel costs. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Les Hudson.
Housing activists have launched a campaign for rent control inside Portland city limits. On Wednesday of this week, a group of musicians will be jamming for rent control outside the Portland City Council meeting. Here to talk about that is recording artist David Rovics. David, thanks very much for coming into KBOO today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
David, why are you planning to play music outside the council meetings?
It's largely, I thought of doing this for therapeutic purposes, really, because I've been, since I moved to Portland 9 years ago, my rent has almost doubled, and my story is similar to that of renters all over the city and the region, and I just have such violent feelings towards my landlord that I've been writing songs about what I want to do to him in order to avoid actually doing it.
And this is safer.
And so I figure the next step is to sing them at City Hall, you know, because...
What section of Portland do you live in, just curious?
In Southeast, not too far from these studios here.
And are you planning to do this at future city council meetings also?
I was just thinking of doing it every Wednesday until my next tour, which is at the end of July. And just because I think having a presence there seems like a good idea, just so that these folks can be reminded, because as people may or may not realize out there, the city council meets every Wednesday morning. And I don't know when else they meet, but I know they predictably meet every Wednesday morning. And so I thought it would be good for them to have a regular reminder that about the people in desperate straits in the city. I have no idea who's going to show up, but I'm an old time busker. I used to busk for a living, and I thought, well, what can I do with this new battery powered sound system I just got? And I thought, well, I think I'll play music in front of City Hall every Wednesday morning.
So you'll be out there on the sidewalk in front of City Hall as the mayor and the city commissioners enter before the meeting.
Yeah, I'll be there. I'll be there singing songs to make rich people and landlords very uncomfortable. I have a whole set of songs that are specifically designed to do this. And then other people will probably be there as well. And my hope is that our ranks will increase weekly until we take over the city.
Now, you mentioned writing songs about your landlord, and your newest recording is called Letter to My Landlord, and your new organization is Artists for Rent Control. It's activism, it's also music. What's going on, and who's working with you on this?
Well, I've just been attending Portland Tenants Union events occasionally, and have been excited about the stuff that they're doing. And I just thought I'd start something else as a sort of ancillary arm to what they're already doing, or what we're already doing, if I can say that as a plural, since I show up to their events. I guess I'm part of the this thing, whatever it is. I don't think it qualifies as a movement yet, but it needs to. It needs to. And it's a desperate situation throughout this country, and I tour a lot throughout the U.S. and Europe, and more increasingly in Europe, because gigs keep on getting worse in the U.S. And I think one of the main reasons why that's happening is that this problem that we're facing in Portland with rents doubling and tripling is happening in all of the sort of bigger, I don't know what to call them, the hipper cities, the financial capitals, the places where people want to move to because there are employers there. Places like Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, New York, Austin, Chicago. This is happening not everywhere, because you can still live very cheaply in places where there's 50% unemployment, like certain neighborhoods of St. Louis, for example. But it is happening in all the places that have relatively reasonable prospects for finding a decent job. You know, this is, it's a massive national problem, and this is not a problem to anything close to this degree in the countries in Europe I play in. And I understand that their difference is that they have laws that regulate these things, you know.
Would that be rent control in particular?
Yes, they have effective rent control laws, which don't really exist anywhere in the United States, with the possible exception of New York City to some extent, if you're like old enough. But, you know, they have rent control laws that really actually work. You can live much more cheaply in Berlin or Copenhagen than in Portland, and that's outrageous. These are massive cultural hubs that everybody wants to live in, where there's loads of jobs and really great quality of living. How is it that it can be cheaper there to not only to rent, but also to buy a house? How is that? You know, it's because of laws. In Denmark, you're not allowed to own more than one house. That's the law. That's the richest society in the world.
Which would prevent speculation, which drives up housing prices. People buying houses, 2-3 houses at a time, and flipping them, I think, is the
exactly.
term.
Exactly. You can't
make a profit.
Yeah, you can't do that in Denmark. Well, it's possible to flip houses in Denmark, but it takes a lot of, you know, you're going to pay a lot of taxes along the way, and it's not a particularly lucrative thing to do. You know, it's not, but, you know, basically, you're not allowed to, there's little loopholes. You can own two houses for up to 2 years. So if you're moving, you can own two houses. So there's ways to game the system, even in Denmark. I mean, I recognize that, and I would be loath to, you know, say that I'm, you know, romanticizing any society. I know there's problems, and I know there's somebody, some Dane listening who's fuming, and they're thinking, oh, things suck here too. I know things suck everywhere, but things suck a lot less in Denmark than they do anywhere else in the world. And you know, and we can do a lot better here, and we can follow that kind of example and have those kinds of laws, because housing should be a right, and right now it's certainly not. You look around the streets of Portland and you can see that this is obviously not a right that's being respected to the people here.
And David, you're an anarchist singer-songwriter whose your music's played here at KBOO for a number of years. Are you surprised at this state of the country that's happening right now with housing?
Well, no, I think it's not at all surprising when you consider the forces that control our political processes and the forces that have banned rent control in 48 out of 50 states in this country. Rent control is banned on a statewide basis. You know, that's something that happened on purpose. There are people who made that happen. There are forces at work politically that made that happen, and they are not they're not representative of the majority of the people of this country, who would be generally opposed to that kind of thing, because, you know, these are people who benefited from it. But the way they do it, like, I was in Massachusetts in the early 90s when they got rid of rent control there, and I lived in Boston, and I grew up in the Northeast, and I could see, it was very obvious how people benefited from rent control. You had communities, you had multi-generational communities that had been there for generations, and they got rid of rent control, and suddenly everybody over the age of 50 had to leave. You know, it was it just turned into a playground for the rich. You know, overnight, virtually.
Wouldn't that affect? I know what's called the creative class, and Portland is world renowned actually for that. For musicians like yourself, artists, writers. It for many years it's been kind of a haven for artistic and creative types. How do you see the lack of rent control and these increases in rents and the higher cost of housing affecting this creative class?
It's what's happening is that all the artists are leaving, and that's already happening to such a huge extent in places like New York and San Francisco that at this point it's a joke to talk about those cities as having any kind of a particular creative class. They have entrepreneurial, they have business people who are posing as creatives, trying to make the kind of money that you need to make to put on a theater production in a place like Manhattan and actually live there, you know, which means not doing anything that takes any kind of risks. I mean, I was just talking to a Broadway actor who's leaving New York and moving to Europe because she's so fed up with...
She's unable to afford living in the city.
She's one of the ones who can afford it. Mm-hmm. She works regularly, full-time, more than she can work. But but she doesn't want to live in a place that's where all the cool people had to leave because they can't afford to live there, you know. And so, of course, Portland, of course, the reputation a place has is usually several decades behind the reality, you know. So I don't know for how long people are going to be talking about Portland as this haven for artists and musicians and all this, but it is less and less so by the day. You know, they're all leaving.
I guess we could look at San Francisco as a possible future for Portland, and yeah. That's highly gentrified, taken over quite a bit by the high-tech community there. I know I've been going there for 20, 30 years, and it's changed considerably, and that's one of the most difficult places to afford housing in the entire country.
It's completely impossible, and it's also important to point out that also what we're talking about here, when we're talking about artists being able to afford to live somewhere or not, what we're also talking about by extension is the entire working class, because the artists you're talking about is basically the more vulnerable, economically vulnerable elements, but that very much includes anybody working retail. And, you know, we're talking about ethnic cleansing. You know, San Francisco, I lived in a neighborhood there that was 99% black. Now there's hardly a black face to be seen in the entire city.
Oh, David, we have one last question for you, and sorry we have to cut this a little bit short, but how can our listeners support your project? Again, you'll be out in front of City Hall Wednesday mornings.
Yeah, come to City Hall 9:30 a.m. any Wednesday morning, and on Facebook, we're Artists for Rent Control.
Oh, David, thanks very much for coming into KBOO. That was singer-songwriter David Rovics. He'll be holding a Jams for Rent Control this Wednesday from 9:30 a.m. to noon. During the Portland City Council meeting, his newest recording, as we mentioned, is called Letter to My Landlord on the David Rovics page on Bandcamp.com. Find out more about his political effort on the Facebook page, Jammin' for Rent Control.
I need to record that.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after tonight's newscast for an in-depth interview with Mary Wood, a law professor at the University of Oregon and faculty director of the school's Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program. Professor Wood discusses climate change and the lawsuit in federal court here in Oregon that was brought by a group of young people against the U.S. government. The suit alleges that the government is violating their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property by causing dangerous carbon dioxide emissions to be released into the atmosphere. That's followed by Labor Radio at 6, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. This week, host Doug McVeigh speaks with Jason Zeidenberg, Director of Policy and Research for the Justice Policy Institute. They'll be discussing sentencing reform and how criminal justice policies are being handled in this year's election. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, slight chance of showers between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m., then areas of drizzle after 5 a.m. Mostly cloudy with a low around 49. Tomorrow, areas of drizzle before 8 a.m., then showers likely mainly after 11 a.m. Mostly cloudy, high near 60. Today in history, in 1898, President William McKinley asked Congress for a declaration of war against Spain. In 1945, American soldiers liberated the Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany. And in 1968, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1968, prohibiting discrimination in the sale, rental, and financing of housing. The quote of the day is from the American civil rights leader Dorothy Height, who said, "There is no contradiction between effective law enforcement and respect for civil and human rights. Dr. King did not stir us to move for our civil rights to have them taken away in these kinds of fashions."
It's 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Exciting news, people. The Republican Party's establishment has a secret plan to stop its blue-collar voters from supporting Donnie Trump. Their plan is codenamed Operation Paul Ryan. Good grief. The GOP's old-line clique of congressional bulls, corporate funders, lobbyists, and right-wing think tanks is as confused as goats on AstroTurf when it comes to grasping a core part of Trump's appeal. He's reaching out to longtime Republican voters who finally realized that it's the party's own Wall Street elites who knocked them down economically, and the party's insider cadre of K Street influence peddlers who've shut them out politically. The party powers are insisting that the Donald is winning only because he's drawing voters who are ignorant, racist, xenophobic, and misogynist. In fact, he's drawing huge numbers of disaffected Republicans who are mainly anti the party's own power players. Far from being coke-headed, laissez-faire ideologues, these voters liked Trump's opposition to job-busting trade scams, his mocking of big-money campaign donations, his call to hike taxes on Wall Street's pampered hedge funders, his support for Social Security, etc. For these voters, Operation Paul Ryan is a dud, a farce, and an insult. Representative Ryan has long been the kept darling of the Wall Street K Street crowd. The obtuse establishment snootily calls him serious presidential material, only because he champions such plutocratic policies as privatizing Social Security, cutting taxes on the super-rich, deregulating Wall Street, and turning Medicare into a voucher system. The only thing serious about Ryan's agenda is that it's a dead serious loser with a great majority of Americans. This is Jim Hightower saying, trying to knock off Trump for Ryan is a sign of the GOP's irreversible decline into cluelessness and political irrelevance.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Racial Justice Organizing Committee, along with the Salem-Keizer NAACP, is holding a workplace rights workshop on May 21st in Salem. The free training on workplace rights will be focused on women, young people of color, and the LGBTQ communities. It's intended for people who work in non-union environments and who need to know how to get some power at work and how to turn bad situations around. For more information, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Bob Rossi of the Racial Justice Organizing Committee.
It's Saturday, May 21 in Salem. It's a hands-on workshop taking up questions about our rights at work and in the workplace. It's designed for young people of color, women, and LGBTQIA youth. Hopefully people come out of it empowered to organize at work and take on questions of social justice at work. Young people of color, women, and LGBTQIA youth here don't have access to a lot of the information that we're getting out. It's that no one talks to those communities particularly about their rights at work. So I think we're going to be ending up taking up a lot of questions about wages and wage theft. If people are being suspended or fired unjustly, what do they do? How do they organize around it? And we're going to be fortunate to have with us, facilitating this, attorney Corina Spencer-Shurick of the Northwest Workers Justice Project coming down from Portland, and some local people as well to facilitate and take up any other questions that may come up.
Can you explain what is wage theft? How does that happen exactly?
Well, typically down here in Salem, the situation that we encounter most with young people of color is folks working off the clock and not getting paid, or time cards being altered, and people not getting paid for all of the time that they put in. Those are the things that we hear most often. But we also hear complaints, particularly from women who work in the nursing home industry, of not being able to negotiate a proper starting wage based on experience, so that the employers get the benefits of the experience that workers bring to the job with them, but don't compensate the workers for that full experience. Those are typical forms of wage theft that we hear about.
What other kinds of situations do young people find themselves? Can you give some examples?
Well, I think that any injustice can be met with organizing, and the workers are usually going to end up with something better than where they started. A typical situation might be someone showing up late for work, or maybe a no-call, no-show situation even, and they're suspended for 6 months, we've heard, in some of the big box stores, and because they need the work, they return to work months later. A suspension that lasts 6 months is not news to us. People who are promised certain benefits or experience on the job that they don't get, so they're not getting help building their careers, is also something that we hear a lot about from young people of color in the area.
And they do have recourse. It's not.
Yeah, I think so, and I think a lot of the recourse is based on people's ability to organize on the job and push back and fight back. Of course, you need to know what your rights are in order to do that successfully. I think we're in a situation where the community can be involved in some of these struggles and be supportive of the young people who are fighting back.
Will most of the people there be not union members?
This is not a training intended for union members. This is a training intended for folks who work in non-union sectors. And in Salem, that means primarily, when we talk about women, people of color, LGBTQIA youth, it means people who work in the healthcare and retail ends of the industry for the most part. Those are the two areas where the people we're trying to reach work for the most part.
And, of course, this will be on Saturday the 21st.
Right, Saturday, May 21, 1 to 3 p.m. at the OEA offices. It's 2540 Coral Avenue Northeast. It's free, and the materials are free. We just ask people to register ahead, let us know they're coming.
How do they get in touch, and where do they go to find more information?
Okay, we have a special email address set up, salemorjustice@gmail.com. That's salemorjustice@gmail.com. This class is part of an ongoing effort by the Racial Justice Organizing Committee in Salem. The Racial Justice Organizing Committee formed last year. We had Alita and Marisha come down and speak, and then that was followed by Jamu Umi, both from Portland. And at each one of those events, we drew in hundreds of people. And we've sustained that organizing that they helped kick off. We are white allies of people of color organizations here. And one of our principles is that we're going to show up, and the other one is that we're going to try to meet the needs of those organizations as allies. And this workshop is one effort to meet a community need. It's something that we think as white allies we can provide for the community based on the past organizing that we did with Walita and Jamu and others.
I've been speaking with Bob Rossi. He is with the Racial Justice Organizing Committee. Bob, again, thank you for all your time.
Thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Again, that workshop is May 21st in Salem, Oregon. If you would like to register for this workshop, the email address is salemorjustice@gmail.com.
Wall Street investment bank Goldman Sachs agreed today to pay $5.1 billion to settle claims over the bank's role in the subprime mortgage crisis. The settlement includes a $2.4 billion civil penalty and a $1.8 billion for borrowers and communities affected by the housing crisis. Benjamin C. Meiser, head of the Justice Department's Civil Division, said in a statement, quote, "This resolution holds Goldman Sachs accountable for its serious misconduct in falsely assuring investors that securities it sold were backed by sound mortgages when it knew that they were full of mortgages that were likely to fail." This is the fifth settlement reached by a panel President Obama formed in 2012 to investigate the lending practices of the country's largest financial institutions leading up to the Great Recession. The panel, called the Residential Mortgage-Backed Securities Working Group, has previously reached settlements with J.P. Morgan Chase, who agreed to pay $13 billion, and Bank of America, who agreed to a settlement of $16.6 billion. Citibank settled for $7 billion, and Morgan Stanley agreed to pay $3.2 billion. In none of the cases, however, were any individual bank executives held responsible for the criminal behavior that led to the settlements. Activist groups criticized the deal as too lenient, noting that Goldman Sachs' $5 billion settlement is much less than the company's recent profits. They also note that Goldman Sachs will be able to deduct some of the cost of the settlement from its taxes, and all company employees who received a bonus from the illegal activity were able to keep the bonus with no penalties.
Greyhound Bus Lines has entered into a consent decree with the U.S. Department of Justice to resolve a suit brought by the department under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The department alleged that Greyhound engaged in a nationwide pattern of violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by failing to provide full and equal transportation services to passengers with disabilities. Alleged violations include failure to maintain accessibility features on its bus fleet, such as lifts and securement devices, failure to provide assistance to passengers with disabilities when boarding and exiting buses at rest stops, and failure to allow customers traveling in wheelchairs to complete their reservations online. Greyhound still denies the allegations. However, it has agreed to compensate individuals who say they were harmed. Greyhound has also hired a claims administrator to distribute compensation. There is no cap on the number of people who may submit claims. To be eligible for compensation, a person must be disabled. They must have traveled or attempted to travel on Greyhound between February 8, 2013 and February 8, 2016, and must have experienced a disability-related incident during their travel or attempted travel. Claims must be filed by November 10th of this year. For more information, go to ada.gov.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zurr, Robin Ryan, Jeff Henderson, Les Hudson, Ken Jones, and Rosalind Scott. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Jenna Yokoyama. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Representative Greg Walden is at 541-389-4408. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, Joe Uris asks, are Portlanders being poisoned by local businesses? His guest is journalist Paul Koberstein. At 9 on Alternative Radio, physicist, scholar, and social activist Vandana Shiva speaks on We Are All Seeds. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, they focus on Milagro Theater's Into the Beautiful North and Theater's Vertigo, Love and Information. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews designers Cecily Pines and Kate Bingaman Burt about Design Week Portland. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a KBOO member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Stay tuned for an in-depth interview with Mary Wood, a law professor at the University of Oregon and faculty director of the school's Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program. KBOO reporter Jenny Yokoyama speaks with Professor Wood about climate change and about a group of young people who have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government, alleging that the government is violating their constitutional rights by causing dangerous carbon dioxide emissions to be released into the atmosphere. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A federal judge in Eugene decided in favor of 21 young plaintiffs and environmental scientist Dr. James Hansen, acting on behalf of future generations in a constitutional climate change case. The court rejected motions brought by the federal government and the fossil fuel industry seeking to dismiss the case. The judge stated that the government has known for decades that carbon dioxide pollution has been causing catastrophic climate change and has failed to take necessary action to curtail fossil fuel emissions. KBOO's Jenny Yokoyama spoke last Friday with University of Oregon law professor Mary Wood on the legal decision and what's ahead.
Who am I speaking with right now?
So my name is Mary Christina Wood. I'm a law professor at University of Oregon School of Law and faculty director of the school's environmental law program. I'm not involved in the litigation, so just so that you avoid asking questions like that, I can speak to the litigation because I'm an academic. I'm a law professor, and I originated the concept that resulted in this litigation, so it uses my scholarship, but I'm not representing any party in the litigation.
Well, let's just get right to it. What are you speaking about specifically?
Oh, okay. Well, today, the Federal District Court of Oregon issued a landmark order in a climate case that is called Juliana versus United States. And this is a historic order because it requires the government to come back into court and proceed into a trial on the government's climate policy, basically. So this was a case brought by 21 youth plaintiffs. It was part of litigation that is now global litigation orchestrated by the nonprofit organization Our Children's Trust. And the litigation is brought on behalf of youth to force climate action.